You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Hi, I'm Margie Nomura, and welcome to the Desert Island Dishes podcast. This is the weekly podcast in which I ask my guests to choose their 7 desert island dishes. These range from finding out about the dish that most reminds them of their childhood, the best dish they've ever eaten, and of course, the last dish they would choose to eat before being cast off to the desert island. I hope you're all well. Thank you for the lovely reviews you've been leaving this week. Someone described desert island dishes as chocolate fondant in podcast form, which might just be the best thing anyone's ever said to me, and I'm thinking of getting it tattooed. What do you think? If you haven't already, then this is just a friendly reminder to click that 5-star rating on iTunes and leave a review, which, you never know, I may also end up getting tattooed. I was so excited to sit down with Felicity this week. I describe her as one of the biggest names in food writing, and I could see her immediately recoil at that because she's very modest, but it's true and I stand by it. There's all sorts in this one, from dishwashers to chicken Kievs, melon ballers, eyeballs, and everything in between. Enjoy! My guest today is Felicity Cloak. Felicity is an award-winning freelance journalist and writer. You may know her from her infamous Guardian column, How to Make the Perfect, or perhaps from her column in the New Statesman, or perhaps from her many other writing features. She has written 5 books with more in the pipeline. Her writing and recipe testing is meticulous and has made Felicity one of the biggest names in food writing today, with her recipes being some of the most trustworthy around. She has been crowned the nation's taster-in-chief, and Jan Moyer says she oozes trustworthiness the way a figgy pudding oozes spicy fumes. Welcome, Felicity.
Very nice to be here. What an introduction. I've not heard that quote before, so I'm delighted. Get that tattooed on me.
There were quite a few different quotes that I could have chosen for that, but I think to be compared to a figgy pudding is quite something.
The highest of accolades.
And Felicity, for someone who writes as much as you do, and you may well be relieved to hear this, but I could find out really very little about you and your childhood by having a real nose online. I did manage to find out that you grew up in Hertfordshire, and I did gather from one of your books that you have a brother. I know that because you referenced his ability to spot the leaking chicken Kiev and swiftly pass it on to you. So I'm excited to talk about the first desert island dish, and that's the dish that most reminds you of your childhood.
You just stolen my thunder because it is the chicken Kiev, I'm afraid.
That's a great answer.
I also think it's not only, I have a sister as well, but she is not, she's not a chicken Kiev thief.
Okay.
So she doesn't get publicly shamed in my books. But I think it's because I grew up in the 80s and chicken Kiev, I know it's a 70s dish, but you know, in Hertfordshire, we were perhaps a little bit behind the times, and that was the height of, it was a real treat dish for us. And you know, I'm not saying that my mum went out and made them. She worked. They came from the supermarket. They were delicious. I'm not going to apologize for that. I do make them actually now, and they are as delicious, but I still have a soft spot for those supermarket versions.
Yeah, I think they're one of those things where there is no shame in buying it.
Yeah, I look at them and I think, oh, sometimes if I see them reduced, I buy them.
Yeah.
we would have them as a treat maybe on a Friday night, and they would be oven baked. And my brother, older than me, taller, would be in charge of getting them out of the oven. And he just knew when the garlic butter had leaked out, because there's always one that would come out.
Yeah.
And he just had a sixth sense. You'd think that they would look different. They didn't to me. But he would, you know, and I wouldn't know until I cut into it.
So disappointing.
But he recently sent me a picture, and he'd done it to his own kids. And I was just,
oh my God,
perpetuating this resentment. So yeah, the chicken Kiev, mashed potato, peas, classic.
He's very serious about his chicken Kievs. And I read in one of your recipes that there are sort of different techniques to stop the butter oozing out. And you say that one of the best ways is to wrap it in cling film, I think.
Yeah, so you can do all sorts of slightly sinister stuff with meat glue.
Okay.
And
wait, what?
Yeah.
Like an actual glue for meat?
Yes, it's sort of, I think it's an enzyme and it fuses the meat together.
Okay.
I don't really like to, I don't object to that. It's not dangerous, but it's not something that I really want to keep in my kitchen. And I suspect that lots of your listeners probably won't have it to hand either. And it's actually as easy, I think, because I did try the meat glue. I bought some. It's as easy to freeze. So you wrap it in cling film so it's very tight and then you freeze it, not all the way through, but just so the outside freezes and that sort of fuses it together. So it's a much easier way and there's no leakage.
That's a top
no
tip.
Leakage at all.
I also read that another one of your earliest food memories was gnawing on a plastic wrapped Stilton that you grabbed off the supermarket shelf when you were in a buggy, which, I mean, that must have been a shock.
Thing is, it's such an early food memory that I would think it was false, except that A, no one else talks about it in my family, so I remember it. And B, it's a sort of real visceral memory. I can really, really remember the sensation of the blue cheese through the cling film. And I liked blue cheese from a really early age. Yeah, I remember people saying, oh, you won't like that when you had Roquefort on a Christmas cheese board. I loved it. And I was actually quite a fussy eater as a child. But no, blue cheese, I've always loved it. And nowadays I do tend to eat it without the plastic wrap.
Yes.
It didn't put me off.
No, well, that's saying something, isn't it?
I hope my mum bought it afterwards.
You say you sort of accidentally got into food writing. You studied English at Oxford and after that went into publishing. But you realised very quickly that that wasn't for you. Was that a case of realising that you did actually really want to write yourself rather than commissioning others?
Yeah, well, I mean, I never got to the grand stage of commissioning anyone.
Okay.
I don't want anyone that worked with me in that time to fall about laughing. I realised that I really wanted to write and there wasn't that much scope for it. Obviously, publishing other people's writing. So I got out of that quite quickly and fell into food because I was interested in it. And it just seemed a really exciting thing to be part of because food writing encompasses so many different things. You know, there's travel, there's history, there's sort of scientifically based things, which I'm less good at, but I find interesting. It's just such a broad range. Everyone has to eat.
Yeah, that's so true. And where did you begin? Because what did it look like from when you decided that you wanted to write about food to actually going about writing about food?
Where did I begin? I'm trying to think of the first thing I wrote that was ever published. I went and did lots of work experience at food magazines and I remember being so excited because I think Waitrose magazine got me to write a quiz question.
Ooh.
And I can still remember it. It was something about which fruit has its seeds on the outside or something. And strawberry, it wasn't that.
Okay.
I was so delighted to see it in print. It was such a thrill. And now I just feel I used to buy everything because then I went and did lots of other, I worked for magazines for a bit and then I got into newspapers when I went freelance and I used to go and buy every single paper, not every single copy of the paper, but every single newspaper that I was in. And now I mean, I still get excited if I see it, but I'm less.
Well, yeah, if you did that, you'd like literally your flat would just.
Yes.
You'd be like one of those hoarders on TV.
Well, I think I already look like a hoarder. So I do sometimes if I've got a nice sort of glossy feature, I do go and buy it.
Yeah, it's very important to do that, I think.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the second desert island dish. And that's the first dish that you learned to cook.
So I think it was probably apple crumble, which is. It's an unexciting dish, but it's a profoundly satisfying one. I absolutely love crumble. And I don't think that I ever got it at home. I remember it being very sort of sandy and not like the ones we used to get at school, and which was sort of big, craggy lump. The one that I made at home was probably quite sandy and fine. And it was still delicious, but it wasn't a patch on the one we got at school that was big craggy rocks of crumble on top and slightly doughy beneath.
Mm.
And so delicious. Just amazing. but I still loved it. I love any combination of butter and sugar, to be honest. And then I would also have made the bird's custard, but it's still my absolute favourite accompaniment
to
British puddings.
Okay.
I do not get the denigration of bird's custard, which is basically just a cornflour thickened sauce. Everyone's fine about, say, bechamel or any kind of white sauce, but custard, people are very snooty about it. Like, egg custard is necessarily superior. And I love a creme brulee and a creme caramel, etc., etc. But there's a place. They're too rich, I think, for especially British puddings. You don't want that kind of base. I like a custard. I'll be honest. I like a custard that you can drink.
Okay.
And even I can't put away that much egg.
Well,
custard. So, yeah.
But yeah, you're right. It's the doughy, squidgy bit touching the fruit, isn't it?
So good. Delicious.
Do you think it's possible to make a bad crumble?
No, I don't, to be honest. I mean, having made a few bad crumbles in my early years,
I still
enjoyed them. But I realized that a secret, I think I took it from Nigella's How to Eat, was to chill or freeze the mixture before you put it on the fruit, so it sort of clumps together. And also to get some liquid in there, like a little bit of water or something, which is, I'm sure, what they did at school. And then that helps it clump together.
Interesting that you hark back to your school version, because that's quite rare, isn't it?
I have to say that some of the food at school was very, very bad. And I flirted with being vegetarian at school for that reason. I mean, I say vegetarian, we still used to go to McDonald's. but the puddings were excellent. Mm. And that they did a lot of, you know, stuff like cottage pie and stuff was great. It was just, there was a lot of potato smiley faces, which, which I've really gone off in recently.
You can only have so many.
I can still have a potato waffle, but a smiley face now.
So let's talk a bit about the Guardian column, How to Make the Perfect. You started it in 2010. I mean, getting a column from the get-go is pretty impressive. Has it been the same format ever since you started it? How did that come about?
The Guardian column came about. I had actually been writing for them, doing another column, which was sort of food-related. It was for their food section of the website, but it was on modern manners. So it was sort of a jokey thing about, you know, what to bring to a dinner party or something like that. And then this one actually started, if you go right back, and I've done it recently, and it, you know, it's about 15 pages of columns, so I wouldn't advise it. Trust me on this. If you go right back, it started as a column about food myths. So I think the first one was whether you should wash mushrooms or whether it's true that they became waterlogged, whether you should seal steak. And then we did one about whether you should, how best to cook sausages, which basically was just an excuse for me to make loads of jokes about Ainsley Harriet and pricks with forks.
Oh.
but it went down really well online, because it turns out British people really feel passionately about sausages. They want to talk about it. So the next week we did mash, and that went crazy because we love mash even more than we like sausages. And so I think I was away at the time, and I was just like, kept getting these emails from my editor going, you know, there are 600 comments on this, which was not my usual. And so then we decided to sort of make it, it evolved into How to Make the Perfect from that. And then a few months later, they decided it was doing so well, they put it in the paper. So initially it was just online. And I still remember the first day it was in the paper, and it had my scone. Because at that point, I took all the photos. My scone was on the masthead of The Guardian.
Oh, my goodness.
And I was so excited. And I was actually working at the Metro at the time. so in the same building as the Evening Standard and the Daily Mail and things. It is quite hard to get a copy of The Guardian.
Oh, yeah.
There. I told you. I was hunting high and low for this. And I definitely bought that and kept that.
Oh, my God. Exciting. That's so exciting.
It was.
And I'm sure everyone listening has read your column, although excitingly, there are people listening all over the world. So just in case anyone isn't familiar, give us the column in a nutshell.
So I'll take a classic dish, so say a scone, or, you know, it doesn't have to be a British dish. It can be a ragu bolognese or a chicken korma or something from anywhere, but something that's classic and that people will be familiar with. And then I'll try and find 5 or 6 different recipes for that dish that have something significantly different about them. So, for example, with a scone, what kind of flour you use or what kind of fat, how you cook it. And then I will cook all of those different dishes, and then I'll see what works and what doesn't. And I'll sort of magpie-like take elements from all of them to make a perfect recipe. But why I think the column works is that I also talk about the things that I've done. So if you don't happen to agree with my taste, because everyone's taste is different, yeah, obviously, you can say, well, actually, I think that I would prefer brown sugar in my scone or something. I'm going to give that a try because that's what Delia Smith, for example, does. I think it just gives people options.
Yeah, it's really
just a nice overview for people, basically.
Yeah, it's so clever because you're providing them with sort of a definitive recipe. But then, as you say, you also give options and you're sort of talking through what other people have done. So you can make a decision from there. And in effect, you're doing all the legwork for people because, I mean, it's laborious for each column. Yes. It's not for the faint-hearted and it's definitely not half-hearted. Did you know what you were taking on when you sort of decided to do this? Because it's a lot more work than just a standard recipe column.
No, I did not know what I was taking on. I don't regret it, but it is such a lot of work. And there have been weeks where I have just been sent almost mad by the shopping. And like, people say, why don't you get your shopping delivered? But I'm rarely that far ahead.
Yeah.
And then quite often you need things from different places. And if they do one of those substitutions, that'd be a nightmare. And so, especially if I'm doing a dish with, say, if I'm doing pad Thai or something like that, I will end up cycling around all the Thai supermarkets in East London or, you know, wherever, trying to find specific ingredients. And it can take a day just to do the shopping.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And then there's all of the cooking and the washing up. And that's before you've even started writing. So
yeah, washing up is the killer, isn't it?
When I got my dishwasher, it's a very small dishwasher because my kitchen, as you will confirm, is tiny. But the dishwasher was a really happy day.
Yeah, it's still a game changer.
It still makes me really happy when I put it on.
And we live in a world of countless recipes, but it has to be said that they don't all work, do they? So I imagine a lot of the time you're trying to cut through personal preference and taste. But I can also imagine that sometimes there are recipes that just don't turn out as they should. Is that something that you encounter more than you probably should?
I think I've got quite good at looking at recipes and knowing which ones are going to work. I mean, there are some that if it's really unusual, I try it anyway to see because, you know, they've written the recipe. Yeah. So they presumably know better than me. Sometimes I'm surprised, sometimes I'm infuriated, but you sort of get to know who to trust. And that's why I think people say, oh, you know, recipes online, et cetera, you worried about how they'll affect cookbooks. And I don't think so, because you know with a cookbook that everything's been tested and people have invested in this recipe. Whereas something online, you know, lots of them work, but many, many of them don't. And it's just, you know, if you spend money on ingredients, you spend your time, you've got hungry people waiting for dinner, you just want to be able to trust the recipe. So.
Yeah, there is nothing more annoying than following a recipe and it not working.
Exactly. So, yeah, I keep buying books.
Let's move on to the third desert island dish. And that's the best dish you've ever eaten.
This is such a hard question because I sort of was flicking through the Rolodex of my memory thinking, was it this? Was it that? It's so difficult. But I the dish that I can think of that gave me the most joy, which I suppose is maybe the best dish you ever eaten because food should be about pleasure. And it makes it sound really fancy, which generally I'm not. But for my 30th birthday, my then boyfriend took me for a surprise to Heston Blumenthal's dinner at the Mandarin Oriental. And I had the meat fruit, which for anyone who hasn't seen it, I would encourage you to have a look up online. It's the most delightful thing. It looks like a little satsuma, exactly like a little satsuma on a plate, complete with a sprig and a leaf and et cetera. And it's actually a chicken liver parfait. And it's such a delicious chicken liver parfait. And then the outer skin is like an orange jelly.
Ooh.
But, you know, I've eaten lots of delicious parfaits and this, that and the other in my time. It was just so fun. And, you know, the rest of the meal was a bit forgettable, to be honest, but that dish, and I think because it was my birthday and it was a surprise, and it was just, when I think back on it, I still smile, and I've got photos of me looking like a Cheshire cat with that. So yeah, that's probably the best dish just for the sheer pleasure it gave me.
That sounds amazing, and also really nice to hear, because you sometimes wonder with a dish like that that has become so famous, is it going to live up to the hype? So it's really nice to hear that it does.
It totally did, because I mean, look at pictures, but they cannot do justice to looking at this thing in front of you and knowing it's not a satsuma, but really does look like
so clever. And so to counterbalance that question, I'm going to ask you about a dare that I read about where you ate an eyeball. Do you want to tell us a bit about that?
Not the best dish I've ever eaten. It wasn't really a dish. So a few years ago, it's probably around the same time, I went to do a pig in a, it was called Pig in a Day. And it was, we went to a farm in Suffolk and we went a pig farm, free range pig farm. And we had a talk from the farmers and we sort of went round, looked at the pigs in their fields, the piglets, super cute. Obviously, being food writers, we went and butchered a pig. Some people will still find that weird, but that's what we did. And we were making, it was sort of concentrating on eating the more unusual bits. So, you know, someone, a Hungarian girl, cooked some brains with paprika, which was really super delicious.
Really?
And I don't think I'd had brains before. And actually, I'm not a massive offal fan, but these were really nice. They're very creamy and they're not offally at all. They're lovely. I haven't cooked them myself, but I totally would.
Yeah.
Anyway, and so there was that. And we made some morcilla, Spanish black pudding with blood and so on. And then there was the eyeballs that were sitting there and had very blue eyes.
Oh no, Felicity.
And this guy, this younger guy, he said, oh, can you eat the eyeballs? And no one happened to know whether you could eat the eyeballs. I don't know if anyone Googled it. But anyway, he said that he was going to cook up these eyeballs. Obviously, there were two of them. And I did not volunteer, I will point out.
Okay.
My friend, who I had taken along as her birthday present, which might make both of us sound weird, but anyway, she pointed out that in my Guardian sort of author bio, it says, I don't know if they've changed it now, it said at the time, certainly, she likes to think she would try anything once, but then no one's offered her an eyeball yet.
Oh,
and somehow
no.
She remembered this. And so she was like, you have to eat it. My problem wasn't so much with the eyeball. It was the fact that no one had a recipe for the eyeball. So basically we were winging it. If I'd gone to somewhere and they'd said, this is the traditional way that we eat eyeball.
Yeah.
I certainly would have had fewer qualms about trying it. As it was, they did it in this sort of, they battered it and fried it.
Okay.
So it looked nice. It looked like a little sort of arancini type thing. And actually the mind plays such strange tricks that as I was lifting it to my mouth, I could see what I thought was sort of blue cheese in it. But as I put it in my mouth, I realised it was the people. Sorry,
oh,
everyone.
My
Sorry.
Goodness.
Sorry, I hope no one's eating. It was just very chewy and salty, and I wouldn't particularly recommend it. But it wasn't, it was edible.
And the silver lining is you'd be great on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here.
That's true.
That would be easy.
That would be fine. But yeah, I wouldn't be rushing to repeat the eyeball otherwise.
Let's talk a little bit about your cookbook collection, because how many do you think you have?
I don't know, because I am not good with numbers, but I have probably about, like 15 feet of cookbooks in the hall and more. They are taking over periodically as a crash, as a pile falls over. And because I use them for the column, it's really hard to, I occasionally get them and I think this is actually not, I'm never going to put something from this in the column, but that really happens because you just don't know. You get a Coca-Cola cookbook. I don't really like Coca-Cola, but you think, well, there's that classic ham and Coke recipe, etc. So I want to hang on to that. And basically, I need a whole library.
I'd say you've got upwards of 2,000.
Yeah, you're probably right. Yeah, next time I move house, which I'm dreading, I might actually count them.
Yeah. Oh my goodness, yes, you must.
Yeah.
And do you have writers or books that you seem to turn to more than others that you sort of trust as a really sturdy starting point?
Yeah. So there was a point where my love of the prawn cocktail years, which is Simon Hopkinson and Lindsay Barham, was getting out of control. And it's such a good book. If you don't know it, it's a book. It's sort of a it's a book of the 20th century in British food. And it does have stuff like sort of deviled kidneys and brown Windsor soup and stuff. But it's also, it takes in the 60s sort of Italian food revolution. So it's got like ragu bolognese, it's got Black Forest Gatto, Steak Diane, all sorts. And just all the stuff that was trendy. It definitely got chicken Kiev. Ooh. All the stuff that was trendy throughout the 20th century. And all of the recipes, actually with the exception of the Black Forest Gatto, which I made twice and the cake didn't work out for me for some reason.
Oh.
The rest of it was delicious. everything else in there is not only works, but is entirely aligned with my taste buds.
Okay.
And everything, I'm just always really pleased when I can make something from it, because they always, with that exception, turn out brilliantly. But there are a staple of people that I know, they work and they're interesting as well. There's some people that I've got where I know they'll work, but they're not necessarily, their tastes and my tastes aren't that similar. So things tend to be a little bit underpowered or whatever. But I've got my favourites, my A-team.
Okay. And I know obviously you're going to be reluctant to name names, but on the flip side of that, are there some, you know, big named writers that you actually kind of avoid like the plague?
Yes, there are some that I just wonder whether all of their recipes have been thoroughly tested, because sometimes you can make them and even taking into account different ovens and being charitable, there's just no way that that can have worked out. And that annoys me, just because if people have spent money, then I think people just worry that they think it's them. You just assume that it's you that especially, has made the mistake.
Especially if you're a novice and you don't have much confidence in the kitchen. It's really unfair.
Exactly. And most people aren't making five different versions of the same dish in a day. So they will not know that it's not their fault. So
yeah.
It's rare, but there are a few that I'm a little bit wary of.
And you kind of do hope that whenever people are writing recipes, they're doing it with the reader in mind and trying to create this brilliant recipe that works. But even if they don't do that, you now have this sort of huge reputation. Do you think possibly they fear having their recipe tested by you?
I very much doubt it. They might think, gosh, she can't cook, because I don't have any cooking qualifications at all. Nor does Nigella, I would point out. But I'd hope that they don't. I always try and be fair to people. And
yeah, you're never mean.
Yeah, so I do. Yeah, I do sometimes worry that people might be a bit angry, because, you know, sometimes with chef recipes, they're not really made to be made in a home kitchen, but then they put them in a book. So,
yeah,
you know, I think I'm a pretty decent cook by now. So anyway, no, I try to be fair and not anger anyone. But I'm also honest. You know, I don't say things don't work. Well, I put the pictures online so you can see whether they work.
Yeah. We're on to the fourth desert island dish, and that's your favourite sandwich.
Again, a hard one, because I do like sandwiches. And because I work from home a lot, I don't actually eat a lot of sandwiches, because there's always leftovers or something. You know, it's a sandwich is actually a bit of a treat for me. The best sandwich I ever had was on, I think, the 1st of January this year.
Oh.
And it was the hot smoked salmon sandwich. I think there might have been cucumber in there, but who cares, frankly. Hot smoked salmon sandwich from the Oban Seafood Hut on the west coast of Scotland. Ooh. And my friend had told me, go for the salmon one. You won't regret it, because they had crab. They had all local stuff, and the salmon came from their own smokehouse, etc. And just a little hut on the pier where the ferries go to the islands. And I ate it on the train back to Glasgow. And which is quite a long and very scenic journey. And I eked it out for about an hour, because it was so good that actually I didn't want it to end.
Oh
my God. If I'd known, I would have bought two and eaten both of them, because they were just heartbreakingly delicious. And I'm not exaggerating. I'm feeling emotional.
Yeah.
But
tears have come into your eyes.
It was such a good sandwich. But otherwise, I think that probably I really like a cheese sandwich, and probably like either cheese and Marmite, cheese and pickle, or guilty pleasure, those cheese and onion sandwiches that you get from quite sort of cheap sandwich places. I was looking for them recently, and you do not get them at even somewhere like Pret a Manger.
No, you but don't. They're I used quite rare.
To at university when I was revising for my finals, I used to really like the Boots Shapers cheese and onion sandwich.
I thought you were gonna say something about Oxford, because they have amazing sandwich shops at Oxford.
Well, but no,
the
exactly.
Boots Shapers sandwich.
No, they do have amazing sandwich shops, and sometimes we used to go and eat like focaccia with aubergines and mozzarella and pesto, and think we were the most sophisticated people ever. But sometimes I'd go to Boots and get the Boots Shapers cheese sandwich.
That's the only thing that will do.
It was I really fond memories of that.
I know you say that it's really hard to study English at Oxford and not dream of writing a novel, but do you think that's something that you will explore?
I'm so in love with the idea of writing a novel. Whether I could ever do so, I've just never tried it. So
yeah, there'd be less washing up.
There would be a lot less washing up, but also there'd be maybe I'd lose a lot of weight, which I don't know, helpful. But I just, that would be so fun to get into another world, but I fear it probably would contain quite a lot of food.
Yeah, but there's, you could definitely combine the two.
That's true. Yeah, a gastronomic novel.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would like to. I'd have to have fewer cookbooks. Less washing up. Seems like a win-win.
Yeah, how exciting. So you've done some very cool things. You've just published your fifth book. You've been a guest judge on the Great British Menu, which is very cool. And four of your books have taken the perfect format, with the latest one called Completely Perfect. As a self-confessed perfectionist, has the word perfect put any additional pressure on you?
Have I said that I'm a perfectionist?
Yes.
That's a fib.
Oh.
sorry, everyone. Do buy the book. It is perfect. No, with the, I have to say that I am a perfectionist in terms of taste. I'm only laughing because in terms of things like presentation, I am quite slapdash. I'm just impatient. And I did a friend's wedding cake this weekend. And I was laughing to myself because you have to decorate them at the last minute.
Yes.
And I was making these tiny rabbits to go onto it. And I was sort of shoving the ears. They actually did look quite good, I think. Everyone said they looked good. Okay, I think they look good. But I was just like, why did you ask me to decorate it? You should have got someone artistic and, you know, they to do it. And
do you think
tasted it? It's the carrot cake. It's incompletely perfect. It is a great recipe. My sugar work maybe needs something to be desired. But yeah, perfection, I do feel in terms of taste. If people come round, I want the thing to be, I want them to, it to taste great.
Do you think maybe meticulous is a better word than perfectionist?
Possibly, yeah. Perfectionist gives the impression that you might come and get some things that look like Heston Blumenthal made them, which is not the case.
And with the other book, The A to Z of Eating, did you feel a sort of sense of freedom when writing that? Because the recipes in that are quite adventurous, some of them. And your perfect column, as we've already said, it sort of, it tends to focus on the classics.
Yeah, it was really nice to do stuff like, you know, when you're greedy and you think a lot about food, things that pop in, like, why has no one made a Marmite donut? Like, not a sweet donut, it's got cheese instead of jam, sort of molten cheese, like tiny donuts. And I was like, why has no one done this before? And I thought about it and I hardly dared Google it because I thought someone will have done it. Never seen anyone else do it. And there's not a good reason for that. If you like Marmite, they're delicious. So that was really fun, just feeling that I could play around with whatever I wanted to do. And some of them are a bit, there's a recipe for soy braised pig's tails in there, which are so lovely. You know, people eat oxtail and it's delicious. Pig's tails are actually more delicious because they've got that lovely piggy flavour. But that's probably not for everyone, that one. But there's lots of stuff in there that's just a little bit. There's a blue cheese cheesecake as well.
Ooh.
Just, you know, playing around with stuff. There's some really great onion rings. The salad's in there as well, lest it all sound like it's really unhealthy. But it was really fun.
Yeah, it's a really fun book to read. And in your latest book, there's a really lovely quote, which I'm going to read now. It says, few things in life are more certain than the fact that when sous vide machines have gone the way of the melon baller and spiralizers are 2 for a quid at car boot sale, we'll all still be enjoying crumble and custard. And that's really lovely because that is kind of the ethos behind the Guardian column, isn't it? Why it's so important to focus on the classics.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I've been rereading Nigella's first book recently, and she talks about how important it is that now we're always in a rush to make the next new sort of trendy recipe. And actually, it's useful to know how to make the recipes that we want to come back to.
Yeah.
And to really know how to make them. And I think that stuff like crumble and custard and a bolognese and even stuff as basic as scrambled eggs.
Yeah.
You know, you should know how to make those things if you like them.
Yeah.
And
a white sauce.
Yeah, all of those basics of cookery that, I don't know, you know, our grandmothers, most of them, and I know that not everyone has a grandmother that's a good cook. In fact, I don't believe that either of mine were particularly great cooks. But, you know, your grandmother would have known instinctively how to make those things, even if she didn't execute them that well. And so that's what the column is for, like the building blocks of, you know, having a really great tomato sauce or something like that. Just, you know, all the things that you should know how to cook.
Yeah, that's very wise. I'm with you on everything. We're on to the fifth desert island dish, and that's the dish you eat the most often.
Probably aside from something like buttered toast, and I do eat a lot of stuff on toast because everything's better on toast.
Yeah.
Probably the single dish I eat the most often, and this is hard just because I spend so much time testing recipes that I relatively rarely get to cook, you know, something repeatedly. But there's nothing more comforting for me than a big bowl of dal. I just love it, especially on a Sunday night. You don't really have to do much prep for it. And it's just like a big sort of velvety hug. And that with some slightly buttery rice is delicious. And it never fails to go down well. You can make it as spicy or as not spicy as you like. It's just lovely. It's sort of one step up for me from beans on toast.
Yeah. I think it's so great because, as you said, you're not a trained cook. And yet over the years, I feel like through your column, you've kind of taken yourself on like a doctorate in food. Does it kind of feel like that?
It does feel strange when I think that, I mean, it's such a luxury to be able to teach yourself to make all of these different dishes and to call it work.
Yeah.
And to be paid great riches for it. No, to call it work is just, you know, sometimes if I look at the mountain washing up and feel cross, I reflect what my friends are doing at that exact moment at 11 o'clock on a Tuesday morning. And I think, oh, actually, these, you know, it's not that bad. But it is amazing. And it's amazing how the different techniques feed into one another. And you sort of learn things that hold true across different cuisines and different dishes. And it's a great grounding. Yeah, it also makes you incredibly fussy when you go to restaurants.
Yes, I can imagine.
When I go to people's houses, I am not fussy at all. I'm just delighted someone else cooks. If I am paying for the privilege, then I can be quite fussy.
And like you say, lots of the things you've done, I've heard you say many times that it's a tough gig, but someone has to do it. And I particularly felt like that over the summer, which saw you head off to France in search of the perfect croissant. Is that for an upcoming book?
It is, yes. I'm currently in the midst of writing a book. It's a sort of travelogue, so it's a bit of a departure, but it's cycling around France. And like the actual Tour de France, it's 21 stages, but in this case, the stages are based around classic dishes. So Bœuf Bourguignon and Quiche Lorraine and Moule Marinière and lots of delicious stuff. And to try and counteract all of this, I did it by bike and I ate a lot of croissant along the way and considered myself a bit of a croissant connoisseur.
Yeah.
And I had to say that the quality of croissant in France are still, unsurprisingly, a lot better than in the UK.
Yeah, I can imagine.
The quality of croissant in Paris is just beyond.
It's very impressive that you did all of that cycling.
Well, you know, you just have to, once you get on, it's not like running once you start. You just have to put your legs round and round, don't you? So,
well, I don't know. I feel like you're sort of downplaying it there. But I think that's very impressive. How far did you actually end up cycling?
I haven't added it up yet.
You need to do that.
I know, I'm saving it.
That'd be the first thing I did. So
well, I know. I'm sort of saving it because it's going to be on the last page of the book.
It's going to
be all the stats with the croissant and the kilometres and stuff. But I think it's going to be several thousand kilometres.
That's a good tease you've done there.
Yeah.
Buy the book.
Find out.
You have a book called The Perfect Host. So I'm interested in your next desert island dish. And that's the sixth desert island dish. It's your go-to dinner party dish.
Now, dinner parties and people that have actually been to dinner parties with me may laugh at this, but that's only because I tend to set them five different things, you know, iterations of the same dish.
Yes.
And make them score them before we actually
that
sit down
sounds fun.
Eat and drink.
Like, come dine with me.
It is quite fun, but the more wine that gets drunk, the more the comments become outlandish. And then the next day, I'm like, how do I make sense of this? But in general, if I'm cooking just for the sheer pleasure of cooking for people, then the watchword is just prep ahead as far as possible. Because even if I've done that, it often ends up being a bit of a rush to get things to the table, you know, while also ensuring everyone's got a drink and everyone's happy and blah, blah, blah. And the dog's not harassing anyone's coat. And so something like something that improves with age, something like a beef stew and dumplings or a chili con carne or a ragu, anything like that that can be made entirely in advance, and then you can just serve it like a beef stew. You can serve it with mash, which is a little bit of work on the day. If you do dumplings, then all you have to do on the day is maybe some green veg. Perfect. Or a salad. So anything like that is ideal. And then actually my favorite dinner party pudding, and it has been for about 20, since I started giving dinner parties, so like 15 years, is one from the Ivy cookbook that I had recently at one of the Ivy in Edinburgh, and I was reminded how good it is.
What is
revive it?
It
is so simple. So you buy those iced berries, you know, that you get at the supermarket. So
yeah.
Frozen berries, they call it iced berries. Frozen berries from the supermarket. Keep them in the freezer until you need it. You make a white chocolate sauce with milk. Well, I use Milky Bar because I'm secretly quite addicted to Milky Bar. I don't allow myself to buy it except for this purpose. always buy extra just in case.
It's so good.
And you just melt some of that in some cream, and then you put the frozen berries on plates, and then people pour over this hot sauce, and it sets like ice magic, if anyone remembers that from the 80s. Everyone, it has that pleasure thing, like the meat fruit. It has that sort of pleasure principle. Everyone's like, oh, wow, this is so cool. It also tastes great, and it's super easy and pretty cheap to do. So also ideal. I wish I thought of it.
That's a really great one. Mm. Dinner parties at yours sound pretty good. On Desert Island Dishes, we have a cookbook hall of fame. What is your most treasured cookbook?
Oh, well, I've already mentioned the prawn cocktail years.
Yeah.
But I think the one I would have to, if I was going to take one book away with me to this delicious desert island, it had to be Nigel Slater's Real Food.
Ooh.
Which it probably has featured before. But it is just, it's the book that got me into not only cooking, but also sort of the idea of food writing, because I remember as someone gave it to my parents when it came out in the 90s. And I just remember we had Delia and we had the book, the dairy book of household cookery that you bought from the milkman. And we had Mrs. Beaton and a few sort of like Nouvelle Cuisine, sort of 80s, 90s chefs. But this was the first book that I looked at and was fun to read. And he made it seem such a cliche now, but he was the first person that did make food seem a bit sexy. And at the time, you know, as a teenager, reading his words about how there's nothing better than the pleasure of a hot, salty chip eaten from fingers, especially if they're someone else's. And I was like, who are Nigel? And just the food is great. The garlic bread recipe in that book is never bettered.
Oh, really?
It's just, oh my God, make it for every single party that I have. It's so good that people have been known to tuck into it, both so hot from the oven that they've started crying. And also once I found someone eating one that hadn't been baked yet. It's quite late on in the party. But honestly, it's got Parmesan in it. It is super, super delicious.
If that's not a recommendation, I don't know what it is.
Well, the recipe, I think there's a garlic bread recipe in Completely Perfect, and it's based on that. So it's an homage to Nigel. So Real Food, Nigel Slater. Just perfect.
Delicious. We're on to the final seventh desert island dish, and that's the last dish you would choose to eat before being cast off to the desert island.
It's trifle. Ooh. I love trifle. I love trifle in all its incarnations. I love those little supermarket trifles you get with jelly, even though I'm anti-jelly in general. I know this divides people, but I will eat a supermarket trifle with jelly. Forced. I love my sister's mother-in-law who comes for Christmas with us sometimes brings Nigella's chocolate trifle with blueberries and amaretto.
Ooh.
Love that. But most of all, I love my granny's trifle that my mum also makes. And now I make, it's just so simple. It's tinned raspberries, it's boudoir biscuits, it's sweet cherry and quite a lot of sweet cherry. And then just a really thick layer of bird's custard. I think now my mum would probably put some fancier custard on, but I still sit with birds.
Yeah.
It sets very well. And then a layer of whipped cream and some almonds. And it just, I know, I just love it. It's just such comfort food for me.
Maybe we can have a trifle banquet and just have all the sort of variations.
It's a joke about a trifle bazaar there that I'm trying to remember, but yes.
Well, that sounds completely delicious. Felicity Cloak, those were your desert island dishes.
Thank you.
Perfect. You know you've made a good garlic bread if someone's tucking into it before you've even cooked it. And I would love to know where you lot stand on melon ballers. I'm not saying they're an essential piece of kitchen kit, but who doesn't love little tiny balls of melon? And here ends another delicious day of Desert Island Dishes. If you're listening and you haven't yet left a review, now's your chance. It really is quick to do and it really does help. You can find me on Instagram at Margie Nomura, and you can visit the website desertislanddishes.co, where there's a full list of episodes, plus lots of different recipes and loads of other things to explore on there. Thank you so much for listening. Bye.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.